Let's turn it over to the program. VK3JED, Tony, it's all yours.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I think that should be enough time. So hopefully everyone's got their PowerPoints up and running in that time. Yeah, we'll be talking about the so-called Black Saturday fires, which really got going on February 7 this year, and the response by the amateur radio community, plus a little bit on some HF to Echolink technology that we did utilise towards the end of the activation. I wrote most of it, but I did get a lot of input about the emergency activation from the Western Victoria Secretary, Mark, VK3X-ray Mike Uniform, and don't be concerned about the date. It is April the 5th over here, and also dealing with the time change as well. So it's all happening. Anyway, moving on to slide number 2, just a brief rundown of the comments. Talking a little bit about the meteorology leading up to the event, then moving on to Weisen Victoria's activation and its role in dealing with the emergency situation, and then finally a little bit on the link between HF and Echolink and IRLP, which we utilise to extend the range of our HF net. Take a short break and we'll come back with slide number 3. Okay, on slide 3, we're talking about the meteorological situation, and this slide deals with the long-term picture down here in southeastern Australia. Much of this area has been subject to a drought of at least 12 years. In fact, a lot of people are calling it more of a climate shift. Whatever the cause, there's a definite change in the weather patterns that hasn't been seen in recorded history. We do get droughts here, but the longest of them has only been about half the length of what this one is so far. So the state of Victoria had experienced an extended period of below average rainfall since the mid-1990s. Around about 1996 was the last time we had near normal rain. Melbourne's rainfall has been around 20% below the long-term average during this period, and this prolonged dry conditions have caused forest fuels, including heavier fuels like fallen trees, to dry out and become highly flammable, break more to follow. Yeah, moving on to slide number 4, to compound the pre-existing drought situation. We had some rather notable weather conditions in late January, the period January 28th to 30th saw the first phase of an extreme heat wave across much of southeastern Australia, from pretty much from Adelaide right through to the all of Victoria and Tasmania as well. There were a number of high temperature events, too many to mention here, but the significant ones for the areas affected by the fire were the most consecutive days over 43 degrees Celsius in Melbourne, 3 days, which were the 28th, 29th and 30th, accompanied by low humidity in the range of 5 to 8%. During this period, we also equaled the most consecutive overnight minimum temperatures over 20 degrees Celsius. That was 6 nights in a row, from 29th of January, the morning of 29th of January to 3rd of February. That equaled the record that was set in 1908, so it's been a long time since that's happened. And we had 2 days in the top five of hottest days. At the time, January 30th recorded a high of 45.1 degrees Celsius, which was at the time second only to January 13th, 1939, which was 45.6. And the fourth warmest day at the time, on January 28th, since February 7th, these have been relegated to third and fifth highest, and we'll look at that in a moment on the next slide. Now, in inland areas, north of the range of the heatwave did continue. Here in Melbourne, we had some relief with temperatures in the high 20s, low 30s for a few days, but the heat came back with a vengeance on February 7th, 2009, which has since been called Black Saturday. February 7th, 2009 had all the ingredients for a severe fire day. The fire danger index, which is a measure used to indicate how likely fires are to break out and how difficult they will be to control, exceeded 200 in some areas. This is the highest value ever recorded. A reading over 50 is considered extreme, and the 100 mark was set at in 1939. The conditions of so-called Black Friday in 1939, which saw some of the most severe fires in the state's history, was the definition of the 100 mark, and here we're having fire danger indexes around 200, so literally the worst conditions ever recorded in the state. Temperatures on February 7th reached a record of 46.4 degrees Celsius in the city of Melbourne itself. Out here in the western suburbs, about 12 miles west of the city, it was even hotter at 47.5. That's getting close to 118 Fahrenheit. So extremely high temperatures. Wind speeds exceeded 100 kilometres an hour, or 60 miles an hour as the prefrontal trough passed through. For more details on the meteorology, there is a link in the PowerPoint, which will download the official meteorological report on the heatwave event from the Bureau of Meteorology website. Break more to follow. Continuing on slide number 6, more on Black Saturday. Several major fires broke out across Victoria during the day. At least two of those were deliberately lit. There was another one apparently caused by a cigarette butt. Arcing of power lines caused another. There were a few different causes, but significantly at least two were deliberately lit. And I am pleased to say that a suspect had been arrested not long after, in the days after, for one of them, and has been in court. Over 450,000 hectares, or 1.1 million acres, were burned. Over 2,000 houses were destroyed. 3,500 buildings or structures in total. Several towns were virtually wiped off the map. Seeing some of the footage was actually reminiscent of the footage from Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atomic bombings. There was literally nothing left but rubble. 173 lives were lost. There were estimates up to 210, but a week or two ago the official estimate was revised down to 173. And at least one pyro tornado, or basically a tornado which consisted purely of fire, was observed and filmed. There is video on the internet of this. It's extremely spectacular. And that ends slide number 6. Yes, moving on to slide number 7. This is a stick chart just as the prefrontal trough was moving through. At this point, wind speeds were maximum. And this is where a lot of the fires became serious, with the high winds and the wind change from northwesterly before the trough that you can see running through the southeastern corner to a more southwesterly pattern. That 90 degree change put the fires on a new front early in the evening of the 7th. Other notable features on this weather map of the high, just to the west of New Zealand, that high in combination with the big monsoonal trough that extends across the north of Australia and the prefrontal trough created high temperature conditions bringing hot air, as you can see, from central Australia on the northwesterlies right down through into the southeastern corner. This sort of setup is quite typical of an extreme fire day, but due to the prevailing conditions, there was an extreme amount of heat in central Australia that was brought down. And being desert air, the humidity was extremely low, around 5%. Moving on to slide number 8, we'll now look at the amateurs and the role of Wison Victoria. Wison is broadly equivalent to Aries in the US. It's the emergency service arm of the amateur radio community. Wison was activated on Monday, February 9, 2009, under the state's disaster planning system. Initially, Wison was tasked with providing a radio link between the town of King Lake, which had no communications and was virtually wiped off the map, and the Municipal Emergency Coordination Centre, or MEC, at Alexandra. Links between those two sites were implemented using a mixture of HF and VHF. Once regular communications were restored to King Lake, telephones came back online. Wison operators were utilised to operate Country Fire Authority and Department of Sustainability Environment radios at the Alexandra Incident Command Centre. The CFA and DSC are the two firefighting bodies that were responsible in the areas. CFA is responsible for fires on private land and DSC on state forests and national parks. And the fire was in a mixture of both. A team of five operators was used to staff the Alexandra ICC and the MEC. And they operated for several days. In addition, a Wison operator assisted with the restoration of broadcast services in the town of Flowerdale. Break, more to follow. Continuing with the Wison activation, Wison provided a link between Alexandra MEC and another town, Narbathong, again until phone services were restored. This time they used 2 metres and 6 metres. There were repeaters available on both bands. Two operators were used for 3 days in this role, and as a side story, the 6 metre repeater was damaged, and they had to make temporary repairs to enable the repeater to be used for this particular link. Due to transport difficulties and the uncertainty of roads being closed, open or passable, a team of firefighters was deployed to a place called McAdams Hill. In this area, there's uncertainty with coverage of the state mobile radio system that the fire services use, and also mobile phones. Therefore, Wison was used to provide backup communication on HF and UHF so that these firefighters were able to communicate with the various ICCs. Wison operators were utilised at 3 more ICCs in the outer eastern and northeastern suburbs towards the end of the activation. Another Wison operator was deployed at Wesburn Air Base for flight following until the operations were closed after the fires. Flight following means using radio to keep track of the positions of firefighting aircraft. Break, more to follow. Continuing with the Wison activation on slide 10, during the period of the activation, a regular Wison net was held on 80 metres on 3.6 megahertz every day at 1000 and 2130 hours local time. This net fulfilled several purposes. Kept the Wison members who were not deployed and the wider amateur radio community informed as to what was happening. Operators deployed in the field could send sit reps to Wison admin who were monitoring the net. Wison admin in turn publicised shifts at the ICCs and other duties that needed filling, and they called for volunteers on the net, which generally got quite a good response. And other amateurs, including myself, I put my HF system up at short notice, tested their emergency communications capability while the Wi-Fi net was in progress. From the 27th of February, activity on the 3.6 megahertz Wi-Fi frequency was linked to EchoLink to allow monitoring from anywhere in the world. This link will be discussed in further detail later in the presentation. Break more to follow. Yeah, moving on to slide number 11, continuing with the Wi-Fi Victoria activation. Wi-Fi also made extensive use of non-radio media such as mobile phone SMS, which their call-out system uses, and many deployments were actually arranged over the phone, which can be sometimes an easy medium to plan things on the radio. Email was also used quite extensively. Members were sent activation updates, at least one of those on Monday to Friday, sent to members, and other people who volunteered were added to the list. These updates were also posted to the web, so the wider community was kept well informed. Over the 28 days of activation from the 9th of March, 9th of February through to the 9th of March, there were 52 different operators deployed. Of those, 36 were members of Wi-Fi Victoria, and there were 16 other non-Wi-Fi volunteers who also took part. There were 4 interstate operators used. The HFNet ran 53 nets using 3 different net controls at various times. We're a total of 617 check-ins during this period. 80 unique stations checked in, of which 67 were from VK3, the state of Victoria. VK2, which is New South Wales to our north, had 5 check-ins. VK4, or Queensland, had 1, and VK7 had 3 check-ins. I notice there's no mention of VK5, but I do know at least one VK5 station that did check in, so there is some data missing. That concludes slide 11. More to follow. Moving on to slide 12, discuss the system use for Link HF to EchoLink and in turn IRLP, as this technology may be of interest and use to the net here. HF to VoIP link was utilised to relay traffic from 3.6 MHz to EchoLink. I was approached in the middle of February by people from Wi-Fi Victoria, since they knew that I was involved in the net here and heavily involved in IRLP and EchoLink. They wanted to know if I could get the HF net on, and it just so happens I had been experimenting with some technology for a couple of years and had been testing it on 2 metre sideband for 2 years. I used the design and the equipment from the 2 metre SSB link to implement the HF link. It's a pretty tough ask. The interface has to reject channel noise, including static crashes and other unusual noises, and at the same time detect speech that's close to the noise floor in amongst all that noise. The system that I use utilises a commercially built DSP noise reduction unit. Not just any old noise reduction unit. It has to be tested that it'll have the right characteristics. The one I use is a German manufactured unit. This is followed by a custom designed PIC-based controller that manages the actual signal detection. To minimise noise pickup from the PC, I had quite a bit of trouble with noise pickup and not having isolation transformers and that around. The easiest way to isolate the PC from the HF radio is to use a UHF link between the HF and the echo link side. More to follow. On slide 13, you can see a block diagram of the link between HF and an echo link. At the top left, we have the HF transceiver, which, for the record, is an old IC745, early 1980s vintage synthesised radio. The audio output from that feeds a DSP, which the role of the DSP is to push the noise floor down as much as possible and enhance the voice. The setting of the DSP is slightly more aggressive than would be used for normal conversation. A marginal reduction in readability and natural audio occurs, but it increases the signal to noise on the output when there is a speed signal present. That speed signal is passed to a peak detector with a fairly short, around a tenth of a second time constant. The reason the time constant is so short is that the peak controller does the analysis of the signal, and the peak controller has some customised timing values to reject short pulses as noise, such as static crashes, and accept long-term, long-duration peaks as voice. The software in the PIC controller is open source. I haven't actually put it on the web yet, but I am releasing it under the GNU General Public License, so anyone is welcome to look at the source and tinker with it and re-release it. The audio from the DSP and the PTT from the PIC controller go to the UHF transmitter for the local link, which is received by another radio at the EchoLink PC, and then that's fed to EchoLink, that link of FM, that's fed to EchoLink by conventional means. So that's pretty much the green line is the control path. The audio path is slightly different, that the audio comes direct from the DSP to the link transmitter. And you'll see there's some orange elements. The orange path is a proposed future upgrade for allow full two-way operation. I haven't implemented that yet, but do plan on experimenting that during the winter with the Wi-Fi net. Break more to follow. Moving on to slide number 14, looking at future upgrades to the HF to VoIP link. Hang on a sec. The link was designed in such a way that it could be easily upgraded to full transmit-receive capability by adding a UHF receiver at the HF radio end and the appropriate audio and PTT lines at the EchoLink PC. The PIC controller, the design and the code in it, because it came from a previous two-way link, it's already got all the functionality required for full transceive operation, so it's just a matter of connecting up the appropriate points on the controller, and it will it can be utilised to put the HF radio into transmit mode, and audio can be fed into the mic socket. One little detail that's not shown on the block diagram is if I want to get in using a UHF radio in duplex, it doesn't show how my audio gets to EchoLink, but that's actually neatly solved. The HF radio has a monitor facility, and when I turn that on, that completes the audio path through the HF radio and back out the receive link into which then in turn feeds into EchoLink through the rest of the chain. The current DSP I'm using does have some issues under certain conditions. If station pops up around 2 kHz, off frequency, it can trigger the DSP and false trigger the system. The ideal case would be to approach the company and have them build a customised speech detection unit that pretty much replaces most of the PIC controller. That'd be the best way, but that'd probably that has to be all done under wraps, since the DSPs tend to be proprietary algorithms. Failing that, a vast improvement can be made by filtering off the higher audio frequencies above 1.2 or 1.5 kHz before feeding the DSP output to the peak detector. Even that change will eliminate a lot of the false triggering. Break more to follow. Yeah, continuing with slide 14, the other thing that is needed is to move the whole system to a quiet country location. The noise floor here for the most part wasn't too bad. The main problem I had was that the interface used by the cable company for the phone and internet tends to generate birdies across HF that wander up and down the band at certain temperatures. They fell smack on 3.6 megahertz. Most of the time that didn't trigger the link, but it caused severe descents. And the DSP, for the most part, did an amazing job at rejecting this interference. However, occasionally the interference would fall in such a way that it did pass through the DSP and trigger the link, which caused a few problems. So moving the system to a quiet location and running it off a DSL link would improve the sensitivity and probably make it quite a good access point for city-based operators too. There's certainly a lot of more experimentation and work that can be done with the technology. Finally, on page 15, just a couple of points of thanks for the Bureau of Meteorology, who consistently do excellent work with their climate analysis and their forecasting. They actually forecast this pretty spot on. Certainly the amateur weather community, as opposed to amateur radio, but the weather enthusiast community and the Bureau of Meteorology here have a very good working relationship. And also to Mark, VK3XMU, Secretary of Wife in Victoria, for passing on the details regarding the activation. Anyway, that's pretty much the presentation. Do we have any questions? This is VK3JED.
Tony, this is Mike Enzer, ANP in Minneapolis. I have a question for you. That's a fabulous presentation. Thank you very much. As I was watching this, I'm not sure if you have heard in Australia about I'm sure that most people in the States have heard about the flooding in North Dakota. I had a chance to go up there and work with those folks for just a little less than a day. It was about what I could spare out of work, some incredible things going on up there, and thank you for your service. I have a question for you, Tony, and that is, how long did it take you to build that HF to VHF or VHF to HF system once you were notified of the emergency?
It took 3 or 4 days. Keep in mind, I was working in spare time, and there was absolutely no preparation. The equipment was all in boxes from moving house about 3 or 4 months previous to when I was called upon to do it. And also had a PC failure during that period as well. I was actually going to use a different PC at one stage, but had a hard disk die. So had a number of extra challenges, so it took a bit longer. Once I'd found a working model, it actually took a few hours to get up and running. I already had the hard parts. The PIC controller was already built and ready, and just a matter of finding the other pieces. to make it work, and working out that I need to use a UHF link and finding the various radios and pieces for that. So yeah, it's about 3 or 4 days from starting work on it to getting it up. But in total hours, probably about 8 to 10 hours. Most of that time was trying solutions that didn't work until I found one that was actually practical.
Well, like Thomas Edison said, he didn't invent the light bulb on the first try. He found 989 ways not to make the light bulb work. So, Tony, that's great. Thank you very much. And I also have another question. Is the Wison program, is that still running? Or is that kind of the Aries equivalent in Australia? Is it still operational for the flyers, or has it been shut down for now?
Yeah, as I said, the duration of the activation was 4 weeks for the flyers, from 9th of February to 9th of March. So, yeah, Wison stood down on the 9th of March when the last operator returned home. We had our last HF net for the flyers on the evening of the 9th of March at 21:30. So Wison itself, of course, is ongoing, has been around for many years, and will be around for some time. We still do meet on HF on 3.6 meg on Tuesday nights at 21:30 local time. Over here, I haven't had Echolink on the regular net since. I want to build the transmit site and then use the regular net for testing. So we're back to our normal inactive state. I say we, because during the period I finally got round to joining myself just in the final processes of getting the administrative stuff done. So I'm joining the ranks, which I've been meaning to do for several months, in 0ANP, VK3JED.
VK3JED, N0ANP. Tony, thank you very much for your comments and your presentation this evening. We sincerely appreciate it. Any other stations that have questions for Tony that would like to jump in, please call now, N0ANP.
I have no questions, but I'll say a quick hello to Tony. Hope all is well down there in Australia, Tony. W1EAV, Marion, Massachusetts, USA.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I'll take one final call before handing it back to Mike. This is VK3JED. If there's any other final questions regarding the presentation before we move on. Yeah, nothing heard. Back to net control, N0ANP, VK3JED.
All right, thanks a lot, Tony.